and welcome to the Psychomedia Podcast. I am Timothy Swan.
And I am Engelbert Humperdinck, and together we are going to answer your difficult financial questions.
Oh, right. I thought we were doing the serious side of sociology. Oh, what a terrible podcast that would not be. Let's not start with not feedback.
It's a podcast on lying, Tim. It's not a podcast about opposite world.
Oh, sorry, I get so... I'm not a very accomplished liar, so I get very confused between bizarro world and just, like, patient.
On that subject, you remember a few episodes back we were talking about the Avengers storyline where Loki becomes a young child?
Yes, I certainly...
I picked that up in Waterstones the other day. I haven't read it yet.
What, the first volume or more?
I think so.
Okay, the first volume is the only one I've read, and it's really good. And, you know, it's ongoing into Young Avengers now, so at some point, Kid Loki is going to join the team. And one of the people I know online, and in real life, I've met her in real life, who's like the...
That sounds so defensive, Tim, it's fine.
The consummate cosplayer of Kid Loki. There was a great picture of her posing with Kieran Gillen, the writer of the series. I was just like, wow, isn't it great? You cosplay a character that this guy invented, and now you're in photos with him. So cool.
Must be weird for him.
Yeah, I imagine it is. But then...
But I figure if you're a comic book writer, that's kind of...
Yeah, I don't think it's as usual.
Territory.
So, yes. Feedback. I am terming this feedback, because I don't think it would have ever come up without the podcast. But listener, Alex Colgan, and podcaster, although I haven't noticed this podcast putting out that many episodes recently, which makes me sad, because I quite liked it.
Wow, cutting.
It's not cutting. It's like... It's not passive-aggressive. It's kind of passive-mournful. Please, do more shows, Alex.
Passive depressive, surely.
Passive depressive, that's much better. Well done, Ben. No wonder you're a real psychologist.
Copyright, Benjamin Fell, 2013.
I would look it up on the internet first. I usually find that when I say something that seems inspired, someone has done it first. But yeah, he sent me an interview with Big Jeff. No brain scans, unfortunately, but... essentially just talking about his why he goes to so many gigs, how he goes to so many gigs, his life story, about some of the opposition he's faced, because a good number of people don't like him very much, which is really sad, because I'm not in that camp. No. My brother, Chris, who is at university in Bristol, once said someone from Bristol described him as a benefit buster. I was like, what does that term mean? My brother's like, I don't know. He's on benefits and he's a buster. I'm just like, that's the thing.
Right.
Where, you know, and I'm like, well, that's not very nice, given that they're, like, incapacity benefits as well. Anyway, it's a cool interview. I will link it in the show notes, obviously. But thank you, Alex, for sending that to me. And as
thank
he,
Big Jeff.
And, yeah, thank you, Big Jeff, for existing. And if we ever do a national tour, we'll totally give you a free ticket. I don't know what you think about podcast recordings as opposed to concerts, because it's not the same transcendental experience.
No, I reckon you could headbang to some of ours, but more in a, like, face desk rather than actually, like...
We could do a live version of Dire Straits. We still need to get the music video sorted for that song. And by me, I mean I, but...
Yeah.
Got to contribute something.
Did you end up listening to my outro for the one on smell?
I've had so much trouble with that episode that I haven't actually gone and tried to listen to the end of it.
Fair enough. It's no Dire Straits, I'm not going to lie, but, you know.
I stand by
it comes to a depressing
favourite one, but, you know.
It's always depressing when you get to stage in a comedy podcast where you're happier with the fact that you managed to get, like, the guitar track laid down really well compared to the fact that the lyrics were boring.
you truly are the Mitch Ben Fell.
High praise. Anyway, I have some feedback this week from the Twitter @shinyemptyhead. Kieran sent us a tweet asking if we'd done an episode on religion yet. The answer to which is no.
The answer to which is yes. Episode 51. Less ghostly, more holy. We did a whole episode, as well as more topics in other shows.
Was it completely on religion?
Yep.
Well, that really says everything that needs to be said about my and ability to remember things that I've done on.
Well, yeah, I'm working through doing a summary page, and I've got up to about episode 20, so obviously it's still in draft mode.
So that may be quite useful for listeners. It will be extraordinarily useful for me.
Yeah, I just, and I, especially for like Franken podcasts and Demi podcasts, where it's not quite clear what the topic was and what things were included. It's quite nice to listen back and just be like, oh wow, we had so much fun with a joke in an episode that we've never referred back to again.
I think the concept of the topic not being entirely clear is true of pretty much all podcasts.
Well, yes, maybe. But anyway, he posted an interesting article, didn't he?
Yes, he linked to an article called Speak Lord, Your Servant is Listening. Religious Priming Activities Activate Submissive Thoughts and Behaviours by Vasily Saragwal and Olivia Cornet and Patty Van Capellen, apparently.
It's an interesting article. It kind of doesn't point out that it increases submissiveness in submissive people.
Right.
But the bit that you found, I think the most interesting, is it increases people's agreement to conduct revenge.
Yeah, which was just brilliant. Absolutely brilliant.
Admittedly, it's pretty rubbish revenge.
Not necessarily that they found the effect, even. Just the fact that they decided that was something they really ought to be testing.
Yeah, I know.
That suggests a reasonably...
Journal of Vengeance Studies does not exist as far as I'm aware.
Right, I think it just says... demonstrates a reasonably realistic reading of the Old Testament. Like, that is definitely a dimension of that component of religion, for example.
Oh yeah, I think it does kind of fit in there. And no, I'm just distracted because I'm thinking about the Red Sparrows. The Red Sparrows once had their
Sparrows are a post-rock band, for those of you.
Oh yeah, they had their kit stolen, like their kit van stolen and all their amps and stuff, so they had to put out a live album to regain the money to buy the equipment to then live tour again. And they called it something like, "O Lord, the God of Vengeance, come and destroy our enemies." I was just like, it's not just like some thieves stole our stuff and we're sad and we need some money. It's just like, "O Lord, the God of Vengeance." It's just like, go big, go home. But yeah, the thing is, it didn't lead to like just like general people taking revenge. If they weren't asked to take revenge, then they would be really nice when religiously primed compared to the non-religious primes. But if they were then asked by an experimenter, it's like, please, will you conduct revenge? They're like, okay then. So it does make people kind of agreeable. But again, the main effect is on people who are already submissive. So I wanted to see what the effect had on kind of dominance. Did it affect dominant people's response to dominance? Maybe. So it is more like
it just exaggerates you on the spectrum.
Belief of hierarchies and stuff. I don't know. It's interesting. And there was no effect of religiosity in any of the studies. So it's just like, so religious and non-religious people are equally primed in terms of their personality by religious primes, but religiosity doesn't have an impact, where they were like, yeah, it probably should. Because if you're in a religion that's like, you know, the more kind of either Protestant idea of kind of independent, individualistic religion, or, you know, a completely different religion that is, again, yeah, less about, you know, part of a community with a priest.
So, what have you done this week, Tim?
Well, I'm not going to subject the listeners to what I did to you, Ben, this week.
Well, I think you should, because a problem shared is a problem halved. Misery loves company, and frankly, this is also a kind of form of group therapy by extension.
The level of audio preparation I would have to do to make that happen is unfortunately too high.
Played another round's worth.
I like that. Episode. Yeah, tonight's exciting episode.
That's how I think of it.
Keep on the Shadowfell.
Of Dungeons & Dragons. It turns out it is almost impossible to find one night per fortnight, even, where the four people involved can actually turn up.
We're all too cool and busy.
But we did manage to get one session in, which was kicked off by Tim deciding that in order to get further into his obviously female character, he needed to use a voice changer.
I think that it was universally agreed that the problem wasn't that it was a really bad voice changer. It was that it was almost good, but not quite.
My issue, in the kind of setting up the voice changer, he was making a sound like sort of bombs were exploding in his room.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that was because of all my audio set up for Psychomedia, you know,
that
because
was
I have
fixed.
To be able to, you know.
It turns out the problem with a quite good voice changer was that about 50% of the time he sounded like Pinky or Perky, and the other 50% of the time he sounded exactly like female Tim, and that was just too goddamn
creepy. And then I shared the picture with the guys, and they didn't like that either.
Like, I was thinking about this afterwards, and whether...
Not too hard, I hope.
Deeply and passionately about this afterwards. And I decided that my response to it was perhaps unnecessarily over-exaggerated.
I think we're all playing
example,
a role. We're role-playing.
But I think it was about... it was kind of a combination of the fact that I am fairly certain that you don't have any desire to identify as female in your day-to-day life. Were that case, I think I would have been completely okay with you doing it. It's just that you're doing it for the purposes of role-playing character in my D&D game.
Your problem was that you thought I was being insensitive to people who are genuinely trans, whereas what I was doing was attempting to play a role.
Not in the slightest. I think...
Okay.
I don't know quite why I have that distinction, but I feel like if it was something that was kind of important to you as a person, rather than something where I still slightly suspect you were just doing it to freak me out...
No, I believe in realism. I believe in getting into my character. You don't understand. I nearly cried at Mass Effect 3. That's how in to my characters I get when I'm doing role-playing of any virtual or real sort.
Okay. Possibly, maybe if it had been a hyper serious kind of...
If I'd been playing session. Abraham Lincoln.
If, for example, every time you hit someone, everyone around the table weren't yelling Moon Mace at the top of their voice.
Well, yes, I suppose the references to Team Kobold blasting off again and your particular description of how the final enemy was defeated by my ability to uppercut using a mace, it does somewhat undermine the realism, my tendency to try and make jokes in between as well. Mm. That's the rest of the party's issue. I like the idea that I'm like this one that's like, I'm really seriously dead. You know, Daniel Day-Lewis... And like Paul Rudd and Ed Helms and stuff joined together to play a role playing game, which is obviously DM'd by Vin Diesel because he's the only Hollywood actor I know who can DM.
I would love to see a D&D game with Vin Diesel, and they really need.
It's claimed on TV Tropes, and I kind of refuse to believe it that during the Chronicles of Riddick, mm-hmm. that he ran a game in which Judi Dench was one of the players.
Oh, that's so cool! That's so cool.
Certainly, so he plays. You are.
Yeah, I am.
Well, good for you. That's okay. Just the first one.
I really
good.
Like Vin Diesel, and I quite like Dwayne Johnson.
Yeah. Well, no, I think they've got charisma. I thought you were going to be excited about the new Riddick movie.
That too.
Yeah. Anyway, have you done anything? What's that, sorry?
Have you seen Pitch Black?
Yeah, Pitch Black is the one that I like. Yeah. I don't think I've even seen Chronicles of Riddick.
True of everyone. But apparently the new one is kind of more of... It's sort of heading back towards, you know, Escape from Butcher Bay, that kind of thing. Which is kind of cool. Anyway.
Excellent. Have you done anything this week? Are you cheating?
Not yet. So, yes, I am cheating. On Saturday, which is tomorrow, I suppose, I will be graduating again because I'm not quite sure I nailed it last time. I think I'd just like another couple of takes, if that's okay.
Fortunately, you get that chance.
Fortunately, I have the academic equivalent of a one-up or a master's degree, as it's also known.
You know, some people work very hard for their master's, Ben. And I'm sure you did as well.
There were times, hours even, where I did work hard. yeah. Anyway, yes, I'm graduating again tomorrow. Last time I graduated, you may or may not recall that it was absolutely bucketing it down with rain the whole time.
I don't. I had it was really hot on my graduation day. Just like, why do I have to wear all this sub-fast? It's so hot.
So this time I checked the weather forecast, and apparently there is 1 hour of sunlight on that day. So we will have to... Thankfully, it is directly after we'll be getting out of the Sheldonian, so we may actually get some nice outdoor photos, but we'll just have to see.
Do you get any special gear for being a master?
Yeah, apparently the way that the gown that master's graduates wear is referred to by the porters, who are the people who kind of organise you renting a gown, is the GIMP gown. Which right. I think is an acronym, but I'm not absolutely certain.
Okay.
So I'll let you know how that goes and whether zips and leather are involved.
Yeah, I'm sure that there were some masters graduating, and I don't remember any fetish gear, but I was mainly focused on my own graduation at the time, so...
And saying Dofidem at the right time.
Yep. Nod. Dofidem. You know, I don't feel like there was one guy... You know, there was one category where it was like a, you know, Master of Studies or something where there was just one guy. And you know what? He went for it. He strutted in, came to the front, and he was like, Dofidem!
For Dofidem. I wish that was the case. Just blow the Vice Chancellor backwards into that. Well, I mean, that's another way of getting a degree. But anyway. We should move on to Media of the Week.
Yes, exactly. So, thinking of graduation... from Oxford University, my Media of the Week is by someone who never went to his graduation ceremony and claims to be one of the most famous graduands of Oxford University. He is, of course, my nemesis, Richard Herring. And you'd say, but Tim, if it's your nemesis, why is he the Media of the Week? Well, I've been listening to his history-based sketch show, That Was Then, This Is Now, featuring one of my favourite comic actors, Dan Tetzel, of Mongrels, as it occurs to me, Lab Rats fame. It's pretty funny. I feel like it's what we would do if we had a budget, because we'd be able to hire a band and some actors to do some sketches about psychology based on our experience as Oxford psychologists. But, you know, if you swap all of that for history, that's what you get.
Would be nice, wouldn't it?
They even have a woman on the show. It's amazing.
Wow. Crazy. We had that.
Yeah, once.
Twice.
Wait, no, twice. Oh, wow. Amazing.
Bad, Tim. Okay, yeah. Good.
So, listen to it. I'll put a link in the show notes. It's fun. And they're only like 27-minute episodes, so they go quickly.
Yeah. Well, my Media of the Week, I may have done this one before, but until Tim gets that, I think we've probably reached like the critical mass of episodes where my amnesia coupled with the number of topics we covered means that it's trending towards certainty that we will start, I will start repeating myself.
Well, I don't know whether the audience will notice. From those who are doing binge listening, like my brother, who was like, I listened to 6 months in 1 week. I'm just
also,
like, wow, that is not healthy.
To a certain extent, like, I think by tiny increments, we have got slightly better at this.
Yeah, probably.
I mean, I think we've probably plateaued, but, like, certainly compared to the first couple of episodes, we've definitely improved. So maybe worth doing stuff twice, see if it's funnier the second time.
For example, the study that I cut from a previous week's episode where you did one that I had done before. So, you know, it would be a different take.
Certainly. Anyway, just trying to decide how mean it would be to say that mine was funnier than yours. But given that
if you say that, then I'll never broadcast it. So you've got to consider, do you want it to come up in a future Franco podcast so the audience can judge? Or do you want to make a claim that means I will delete all of the audio files right now?
I think you should play them one after the other. And let
that'd be great. Simultaneously.
Yeah, it turns out that they sync up perfectly.
Well, knowing us, they probably do.
Yeah. So anyway, my Media of the Week is something that I may have done before. It's a song by the Faroese folk metal band Tyr, who I'm sure I've mentioned them before. In particular, their song Sinclair's Visa, which has been on heavy rotation this week, and whose lyrics I've been trying to learn, which has an endeavour which has been made somewhat more difficult by the fact that said lyrics are in Norwegian. Because the album from which it is drawn contains songs in English, Norwegian, Danish, and traditional Faroese.
Oh, good. I didn't want the Faroese to feel left out.
No. So I was looking up this song to find out actually what language it was that I was learning. Because I always feel... I have this vague sense... there's a couple of folk metal bands who sing in different languages. And sometimes I try and learn the lyrics to their songs. Partly because I like to sing along to them, but also partly because I feel like if I ever went to that country, I might have a slight ability to communicate on very specific subjects, like blacksmithing or ancient history. But so anyway, I was on the Wikipedia page, and it said, you know, the lyrics are in Norwegian, and it gave the lyrics credit. And the name of the guy who was credited for the lyrics for this song is called Edvard Storm, which is an amazing name.
Yep.
And weirdly, for the band, his name was a hyperlink. Because, you know, they're not a particularly well-known band, so, like, none of the other band members have their own wiki page. So I clicked on him to find out if he was famous for other stuff, and it turns out that he's not a member of the band. He's actually an 18th century Norwegian poet. And this song is, in fact, his poem Zinklar's Visa, about the Battle of Kringen, in which a band of marauding Scottish mercenaries were massacred by a force of local Norwegians, apparently led by a peasant girl blowing a ram's horn. So there we go. There's a tiny Norwegian history lesson free with this week's episode of Psychomedia.
Isn't Nordic history great and violent?
I was surprised, actually, because I feel like, generally speaking, in the sort of broad strokes view of history, the Scottish are usually the people being invaded. I mean, they're usually the ones, yeah. Like, or...
But that's just anyone who ever kind of crosses the path of the British Empire, as we learned in some terrible non-news story weeks ago, where it's like, only 10 countries to go before you've invaded the lot.
Yeah, but it was just the idea of Scottish people, or Scots, sailing overseas for the purposes of invading other countries seemed quite weird, but I don't know why it should be. Maybe it's because I don't see Scots as stereotypically particularly seafaring.
Okay, well, I think of all the islands that they kind of inhabit.
That's true.
The real question is,
you don't think of Scottish people invading Norwegians, you think of Norwegians invading Scots.
Oh, yeah, certainly. But, you know, times have changed, and maybe when Scotland inevitably gets its independence, that the people of Norway should look out. Because they might want some vengeance.
Yeah, exactly.
It's like, we're leaving the Union, and we're taking one of the Trident submarines, seeing as you stationed them here for all these years, and Norway, give us this town. Right, so now we've nearly started a war. Let's talk about some less destructive things you can do with your mouth. How can we spot lies?
How can we spot lies, Jim?
How can we spot...
I'm really interested, and you should get on with this topic right now.
Well, maybe they differ in the way they appear from truth. I mean, how can we prosper at the panel game Would I Lie to You, which one day I'm sure we will be booked for. and bearing in mind that when I play panel games, I play to win. But I'm not a great liar. I don't get much practice lying. It doesn't come up that much as far as I'm aware, unless I'm just not aware of it. Well, Newman et al. In 2003 had a plan to figure out where... you know, lying differed from truth-telling. And they used a famous and horrific example. So I'm going to tone this down. So I'm going to tell a story. Once upon a time, Ben baked some brownies, because he's good at baking brownies. He cooked them up, he left them to cool, he cut them into squares and put them on a plate. And just as he was about to serve them to all his pals, in this case me and the Christina, because you don't know any of his other pals, they disappeared. He said that they had been stolen, so we brought in an independent investigator to find out where they'd gone. They asked Ben about them, and he said they were delicious. My dear brownies wanted to be shared by me, and now we won't be able to eat them. Normally, bakers who have lost brownies talk about those brownies in the present tense, but it turned out that Ben had drowned those brownies in a lake and fabricated the theft story. His language, using the past tense, was a clue that he was lying and was a brownie murderer. So, clearly...
That's quite bleak.
Oh, yes. Yes, it is. It's going to get worse. I mean,
delicious brownies are great and all, but I feel like you're kind of sullying them.
Yeah, sorry. just needed an analogy for children and parents. I'm sorry. So, clearly, Newman et al. Argue, liars have some control of what they're making up, because otherwise we'd end up like Joey and Friends, always bringing raccoons into our lives. But clearly, that is a thing I was trying to remember. I was like, I know it's a character in a sitcom. So I was just like looking up bad liar sitcom. And eventually I was like, yes, that's it. Joey always including raccoons. Clearly, there are some elements we struggle to control. And unsurprisingly, they compare this to Freud. But don't worry, I made them wash their mouths out with soap and tell me what they actually want to say. So there are two key components to a lie: a convincing story and a sincere manner. Now, they believe that social psychology is not focused specifically...
Is this why the upper classes are so good at lying? Because they have, you know, many more manners than everyone else?
Well, I guess you could say that someone's bearing, if it seems believable because of the cultural context, will aid their lying, I guess.
That's a very reasonable response to a very stupid question. Thank you. Continue.
They believe that social psychology has not specifically focused on the thing that interests them, which is just a sentence that I've just got appears in many works of psychology. You know, for too long, olfaction or humour or linguistic analysis or squirrels have been ignored by the literature. We are going to change that.
And combine all four.
Well, in this case, it is mostly linguistic analysis, as squirrels can't lie. And probably that has something to do with olfaction.
Unlike scrub jays.
Probably. Scrub jays... can lie, which makes them cleverer than hips. So they suggest word choice. What?
You mean hips? The part of the body?
Hips don't lie.
Oh, yeah, of course. Sorry. Wow. Real slow there, then.
Yeah, I was expecting you to get that right away, given your known partisanship in favour of the Colombian siren. It's a Bill Bailey reference.
Good. Carry on. I've just got the idea of, like, a mariachi police car right now. Probably insensitive on a number of levels.
Isn't mariachi like a Cuban musical style?
Exactly. Oh,
if I'm wrong about that, then it's like double racism, which is the worst kind of racism. Triple chocolate racism. So they suggest that word choice in expression is more informative than what is actually being expressed. So this study is really dark. I'll try and tone it down again. So poets who also bake, who use a high frequency of self-references but a lower frequency of other references in their poetry, were more likely to stop baking muffins on a permanent basis by their own choice, by breaking their baking trays or something.
I've completely lost track of this analogy. I feel like it might be more illustrative to just go back to killing children.
Okay, well, no, they're more likely to kill themselves. Egotistical poets are at greater risk of killing themselves and where egotistical is defined by their word choice. So that's great for me. So let's try a nicer one. Increased use of cognitive words, which apparently include the very difficult polysyllabic word because, are linked to better
grades. Not to mention the polysyllabic word polysyllabic.
Exactly. Well, I don't know if that is a cognitive word. A link to better grades, immune function, and better health. So these guys are way into linguistic analysis. But obviously, it's quite difficult to categorise words in large pieces of text. So they developed a computer program that could do it for them. And it measures words in 72 different categories. And though it is context-blind, it has apparently proven effective in a number of previous studies. A number of previous studies done by the Newman et al. Team.
Of course.
Let's see what the magical word reading machine can do. So,
does it have an acronym?
No, but I'm going to give it a name a bit later. The machine can already judge whether an essay is personal or detached with reliability with human judges, and creating a false story on a personal topic seems to take more work than a true one, because the latter merely involves expressing what we already feel. So the way it's written will probably differ. The main example they give is a really obvious one, and if it's true, means liars are rubbish and easy to spot. They use the word I less. Now, the evidence for this is not great as yet. Obviously, it's something they want to investigate. There's lots of hypothesizing. Essentially, what has been shown in the past is that if you increase someone's self-awareness, it increases both self-honesty and self-referential language, like the word I. There's no word about its impact on self-referential humour, but I'm too busy being single and telegraphing a joke that refers to the person telling it, which is what Wikipedia tells me the strict definition of self-referential humour is. I sat there for a long time trying to come up with a self-referential joke rather than like a meta joke or a other referential joke, because as we know, if you have too high other referential, then maybe you're lying. Anyway,
Yeah, I'm gonna let that one just tail away, I think. Probably
okay.
Best. It die quietly in a corner.
Okay, that's fine. When individuals show defensive or self-deceptive answers...
Tim, this study is dark enough already without the bell and the tumbleweed in the background.
It's the joke. Ask not for whom the bell tolls. It tolls for that joke.
And Jason Newsted. Anyway, carry on.
So when individuals show deceptive and self-deceptive defensive and self-deceptive answers. They tend to be distanced from their stories and responsibility, but that's not been shown in linguistic sense so much as, you know, it wasn't my fault when they're lying to themselves. So, clearly they're building up this theoretical framework here to be inevitably vindicated by their robot servants. So, they mention guilt as being a key aspect of lying, as well as discomfort, and also that lies are more cognitively demanding, and thus, the story that is made up is usually simpler. So there's been some work in the past looking at one factor at a time, but the power of the machines is that they can look at all the variables. They believe their machine would also be better than untrained human judges. And this is how we ended up with Trial by Judge Computer 3000. Merciless lie-detecting computer. So, they got participants to both tell the truth and lie about various subjects. The first subject, abortion. I'm really worried about these authors. This study has a sequence of difficult topics. Murder, suicide, trauma of abortion. Someone had to do it.
Poetry.
Well, yeah. Baking. It's traumatic. Some had to do this on video. Essentially, some had to type it and some had to handwrite it. And they had to write their true feelings and make up their opposite feelings and what they'd say if they had the opposite feelings. Then there was a much lighter exercise, feelings about Friends. Now, personally, I think that it was a show that went off the rails after the first three seasons, and its prolonging led to a collection of singularly unlikable characters, casual racism and classism, which set an archetype for American sitcoms that remains difficult to break. See How I Met Your Mother season 7, where it's literally every episode is like, no, that is a Friends plot. It's like, oh, I can't marry you unless you never see Rachel, I mean Robin, again. So stupid. Really annoys me.
And they don't even reference the Friends episode. I'm sure hasn't How I Met Your Mother referenced Friends in the past.
The adverts for it appearing on E4 had the, you know, over-the-top continuity announcer guy saying, it's like Friends, but without boring Ruddy Ross.
Wow.
Which I really approved of. Ross is the worst.
It is sad that it is now like Friends with all the same boring plots.
Exactly. That, yeah. So, yeah. Ugh. Anyway, no, obviously it was opinions about their own friends. They had to pick two people they liked, two people they disliked, and then tell a truth about one and a lie about the other. You know, so you've got this crosswise thing. So covered all the bases. And they measured their heart rate and skin conductance for this, but don't worry. It's never coming back.
right.
Good. And this was a similar, and so they had to do that for 3 minutes, and basically how long they had to do it, 3 to 5 minutes in each task, obviously a bit longer for the writing tasks. Finally, there was a more complicated task, so they sent their participant into a room with instructions either to look around the room or to find a dollar bill in a book and steal it, and that then an experimenter would come in and accuse them of stealing, and they'd have to deny it. They were told if they convinced the experimenter, they'd get a shiny dollar. Well, not, as we discovered 2 weeks ago, shiny dollars are too valuable for rewarding participants. They got a matte, papery dollar.
A crisp green farthing.
A delicious frog. Anyway, they ironically lied themselves and gave the participant the reward regardless of how convincing they were. So they filmed this interrogation and attached a fake polygraph. Confound alert! Confound alert! Oh, I thought I'd switch that alarm off because otherwise we'd never get anything done. But seriously. So, the point of that is it's kind of a weird situation. It's like you've got to convince this guy you haven't stolen a dollar. But it's like, I haven't stolen a dollar. It's like, you've got to convince this guy you haven't stolen a dollar. And if you do, you get to keep the dollar. They got puny human, puny judges to judge whether each communication in the first three studies, those featuring abortion, were true or false, and they had 7 to 9 judges judge them, and it was purely binary judgment. Do you think it's true or false, or truth or a lie? So they then transcribed, spelling corrected, and removed any stage directions, for want of a better word. You know, the participant laughed, and then plugged the text files into a computer, metaphorically. Obviously, you don't really do that with individual files. So they excluded any variables from the analysis that were content specific, like religion, occupation, etc. And they then, anything that had a frequency of less than 0.2%, and then verbal ticks like and which wouldn't appear in the written word, except, of course, in my notes for that last sentence. So this left them with 29 of the original 72 variables. However, by standardizing results, they could compare someone's sincere handwritten thoughts on abortion to their video presentation about someone they were pretending to dislike. So, hooray! Interesting comparisons.
Yeah.
They analyzed it in quite a confusing way. They did logistic regression a couple of times, And what they did was quite a weird thing, is they used a regression model based on four of the studies at the time and then saw how well it predicted the fifth study.
Okay. Anyway,
these equations significantly predicted deception in the first three studies, the abortion ones, but not the other ones. And their ability to identify truth and lies was about 59% in study one, and the percentages aren't quoted elsewhere, but compared to chance. And again, only the first three studies were significantly better than chance.
Okay.
So they looked at which of the 29 variables appeared in more than one of the studies as being a good distinguisher. And they found there were five categories that did this. First person singular pronouns, I. Third person pronouns, he, she, it. Negative emotion words, obvious. Exclusive words and motion verbs. And I'll explain what exclusive words are in a little bit. When they used a model based just on these factors to predict deception in all five studies combined, it had an accuracy rate of 61%, which was significantly better than chance. However, this could be powered by the original full model working on the abortion-themed studies. The main picture was, and perhaps the one we can implement in looking for lies in our life, fewer first-person singular pronouns, fewer third-person pronouns as well, more negative emotion words, fewer exclusive words, and more motion verbs. Exclusive words are but, except, without, which tend to set up sort of contradictions, which we avoid whilst lying because we think it will weaken the story, perhaps, or perhaps it just they are more cognitively complicated, those sentences built on that with subjunctive clauses. The rest are straightforward. Motion words are words like go and walk, etc. So don't trust anyone who tells you about a journey. I literally never leave my house. I'm totally trustworthy. And they do admit that most of the variance explained is in the area of the abortion studies, but not that clearly if they ran that model on the other types, it wouldn't work and that might be an issue. Now, we might criticise that the machine has done better than chance, but only in a really emotive topic where people are unlikely to lie in real conditions. I mean, we lie about friends or about petty misdemeanours, less so about ethical and political issues that are by their nature really emotionally charged. However, the judges did not do significantly better than chance in any of the cases. And when they did signal detection analysis, sorry, just having a few flashbacks to the horror of sitting in the dark doing signal detection analysis, literally in the dark, it's just like, to do this study, we're going to turn off all the lights for 3 hours, and you have to do this experiment for about 2 hours, and then analyze the data using DOS. What do you mean you don't know how to use DOS? What have they taught you in undergrad? What do you mean I'm in charge of what they teach you in undergrad? Why didn't they teach you DOS?
Yeah. Wow. Just tapped in some this is getting like down the rabbit hole dark we're talking about here.
Well, yes, it showed
it's a good thing I'm going to talk about lying to children in a minute.
Yeah, exactly. It showed that the mistakes were made in different ways by human judges and the machines, in that human judges tend to make a lot more false positives. But clearly it shows that to some extent there's a different linguistic style being used in lies that reflects the other findings about liars being dissociated from liars, disowning them subtly to reduce guilt and discomfort, presumably. And that guilt comes out in the negative emotional words. Even meta-analysis has shown that one to stand up. Which presumably means that if someone is a hater, don't feel bad that they're hating you. They're lying, and probably to themselves. Now, as I've already explained, using exclusive words like but give a less clear, more complex picture that it's hard to come up with without a big cognitive investment. And we humans hate doing anything more cognitive than we have to. Although you think when lying, depending on the importance of the lie, we might actually make the effort. Motion words are apparently also a sign of this. If someone says...
I mean, part of the problem is, I suppose that if just generally using those kind of linguistic structures is quite cognitively demanding, and we know from a bunch of other stuff that the act of lying is itself hugely cognitively demanding, that sort of combining those two together is just kind of too much usually.
Yeah, sure. And yeah, motion words, similarly a sign of this. Someone who says, I walked to the bus stop to go to town, they're more likely to be lying than someone who says, I contemplated the form of red in order to achieve enlightenment. The decreased use of the third person pronouns went contrary to the existing literature. They suggested that it might be the disconnect between made-up examples and more general thoughts used in discussing abortion. Apparently, as liars are more concrete in their examples, they are more likely to use someone's name rather than random pronouns, which seems to me a bit unlikely. Now, they point out they're trying to come up with any post-hoc explanation they can fit in here, rather than saying, oh, well, maybe it's a quirk of the data. But furthermore, context was key. They had predicted otherwise. And they point out that emotionality, just as I point out, might be key, because it's really obvious. Abortion, emotive issue, going to affect the way you lie. Other problems are the limitations to English and possibly American English, and I bet there's a cultural difference between individualistic and collectivist cultures. I'm not actually sure what cultures other than the collectors from Mass Effect 2 are collectivistic, but apparently that's a standard cultural difference. So what
it's quite difficult to get them to fill in questionnaires.
Yeah, that is true, because as soon as you're trying to get like a real honest opinion, Harbinger assumes direct control, and we all know what Harbinger thinks about things.
He does not like Likert scales.
No. So one problem with generalising is that languages derived from Latin are less pronoun heavy. They point out that, and this is like the one joke in the study, so let's give them some credit, the same is true of Latin itself, although instances of people lying in Latin are on the decline. So, done.
That's a good one.
You know, this is a singularly dark study. It starts with a mother murdering her two children, and it ends with a joke about lying in Latin.
A really forced thing. Yeah.
Brilliant. So they point out that the motivation not to be caught, even in return for a dollar, when lying to keep the dollar, had no ecological validity, that people just, the motivation wasn't strong enough. So there's a lot of provisos, but try it out. When someone seems like they're lying, is it all very simple and not very personal? I'm sure accusing someone of lying based on linguistic analysis that you heard on a podcast will not cause problems to your personal life. I am sure about that. I am not lying. And that is that. Let's lie to some children then, Ben.
Hooray! So, my first study addresses a question I think we all face on a daily basis. Is it okay to lie to my child? Of course, this is by no means a simple question. It often, you know, entirely depends on the context. For instance, is it okay to lie to my child to make them stop misbehaving? Is it okay if I promise that I will apologize when they are old enough to understand or when they're rich enough to afford therapy? Is it okay to lie to my child if it would be funny? Is it okay to record it and put it on YouTube? You know, these are all difficult moral questions, and they often lead to even deeper kind of soul-searching questions. Are all lies bad? Can I have one rule for me and one for my child? Am I betraying my child's implicit trust if I lie? Is this even my child? Why are all these policemen shouting at me? Questions like this, they do come up on a day-to-day basis for all of us, I'm sure. Unfortunately, no one, not even the flying purple pixie that controls your brain, has any straightforward answers to these questions. But wait, maybe science does. I'll just check. No, science doesn't. But it does have some interesting data to illustrate the point that parents do lie to their children. Thus, we have study one by Heyman, Su, Fu, and Lee, entitled Instrumental Lying by Parents in the US and China, in which it is revealed that basically everyone lies to children. So that's okay then. Specifically, they sampled 114 American and 85 Chinese parents and presented them with a big list of lies. The Conservative Party Manifesto or something.
Zing. Boom!
Improvised politics, hooray. So the lies were split into...
It's not very topical, though. UKIP are going to be the new second party in Eastleigh, Ben.
I know, I saw. Anyway, on the Daily Mash, it must be confessed.
the Daily Mash and the Onion and the Poke, they're legitimate news sources. You've just got to, like, deconstruct the joke and be like, so what is this a joke about?
Anyway, so they split these lies into two main categories. First were so-called instrumental lies, which are lies intended to encourage behavioural compliance, as the authors put it. And the other set were comparison lies, just a little bit of a misleading title. These were lies intended to induce positive feelings. So, for example, an instrumental lie that they presented to participants was, if you don't behave, I will call the police. And they were very careful to add in brackets after this, brackets, when you have no intention of doing so, to parents of criminally inclined children.
Yeah.
Another instrumental lie that I thought was strangely pointed was, Daddy is not out having fun, he is at an important business meeting, brackets, when the father is actually out having fun, close brackets.
What? I don't remember this ever happening in my childhood.
There is no reason for that to be a lie unless the fun is of, like, we're talking strip club fun, prostitute fun, or, like, sort of Hunger Games-style human hunting fun.
Well, no, the point is, why should Daddy go out and have fun when he could be here reading me my bedtime story? Why can't he have fun when I'm asleep or something, I guess?
Yeah. Why does Daddy love that whiskey bottle more than me? I told you it was going to get dark. Anyway, as for the comparison lies, these are slightly happier. These include things like, it's not your fault that plate broke. It broke because it was too old. Or Santa Claus will come to deliver your presents on Christmas Eve. Or my favourite one, the fairly blunt, that was beautiful piano playing. Brackets, the playing was terrible.
Right, okay, so you haven't heard the podcast As It Occurs to Me.
No.
Which is the successor to the Media of the Week. It's, you know, has the same cast, but it's not history themed. There's a character on that called Tiny Tiny Andrew Collins, who cannot do anything without adding an aside that directly contradicts it. And those brackets are very much like that. So it's just like, that piano playing was beautiful. Aside, no, it wasn't. That's what he does. Obviously, he just says all of the asides out loud and precedes them with the word aside. It's very funny.
Well, this this pretty much does summarise what a lot of the lies as they were presented were. Any of the ones with the brackets, like, there's no more candy in the house, even though there actually is. Don't come with me now, I will leave you here by yourself, when the parent has no intention of doing it. I never liked that teapot anyways. I was going to get a new one. Child broke mum's favourite teapot. So there we go. Lots of lies.
Yep.
So for each lie, the participants had to indicate whether they had ever said something similar to their children. And they also had to give a score from 1 to 5 on how morally acceptable they considered the lie to be. Fairly straightforward. What they found was that 84% of US parents and 98% of Chinese parents admitted to using at least one of the lies on their children. The most commonly used lies were the ones that were most commonly rated as morally acceptable were those where there were false threats given to misbehaving children. So if you don't stop misbehaving, I'll call the police. And in general, Chinese parents rated instrumental lies at more acceptably than American parents. So it seemed like they kind of had in Chinese culture, perhaps it's considered perfectly acceptable to lie to your children to get them to behave. Whereas in American culture, although everyone pretty much does it, it's if you ask someone, they'd probably rate it as morally not acceptable.
Okay.
Which is kind of interesting.
So the difference is that the American culture is hypocritical.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So although previous studies have shown that parents from almost 100% of parents from any culture will say that children should be taught to tell the truth. So in a sense, everyone is hypocritical. It's just that maybe if you ask the Chinese parents, they'd say, yes, children should be taught to tell the truth. And the way that they should be taught to tell the truth is by lying to them. I don't know. But, you know, maybe this isn't actually a big deal. I mean, I'm sure the parents themselves would argue that, A, their lies are for the benefit of the child in the long run, and B, that they only would tell lies to children who are too young to understand the reasons, the actual reasons behind many of, you know, life's complicated rules. You know, it's easier to tell a child that if he or she doesn't stop hurling Lego bricks at passers-by, that he's going to get eaten by a bear. It's easier to say that than it is to explain that if, for instance, one of those Lego bricks were to become lodged in someone's throat, Daddy would have to perform something called the Heimlich maneuver, which is likely to cause severe abdominal bruising or fractured ribs, meaning that even if that nice man doesn't die from choking, then they or their next of kin would be in a position to sue for significant damages, thanks in part to the culture of compensation promoted by the ill-conceived precedent set by UK tort law. Quite difficult to explain that to a three-year-old.
In the short term, yes. It's like with all things like this, it's like eventually the kid is going to call your bluff, aren't they? So you'd be better off going with similar things but moral principles, like, you know, if you don't behave, I will be very upset, and I'm sure you don't want to make me very upset.
Because when I'm upset, bears come and eat you. Bear-based parenting, it's the way to go. Anyway, at the very least, all that aside, you would hope and assume that children who are being lied to are surely much too young to even grasp the concepts of a lie, let alone kind of negatively have negative consequence of this style of parenting by, like, imitating the lying, you would hope. Surely that's the case. Not so!
I'm sure there's no older sibling who's ever called the police because their little sister isn't behaving and they heard mummy say that she would do it.
Yes. So it turns out, as science cries not so triumphantly, Angela Evans and Kang Lee, incidentally the same Kang Lee who co-authored the last paper, I guess he just loves lying to children, and who doesn't, apparently. Anyway, yes, Lee has this other paper entitled Emergence of Lying in Very Young Children, in which he reassures parents that it's okay to lie to young children because those children are A, lying right back at their parents, and B, thankfully, really, really bad at it.
Oh, yes.
So in this study, they got 65 2-to-3-year-old toddlers and brought them into a lab to take part in a variety of standard tests of executive function. In addition to these tests, they got the kids to play a guessing game in which a toy, e.g. a duck, this is basically quoting verbatim from the study, a toy, e.g. a duck, one assumes a toy duck, but possibly a real duck, was placed out of sight of the child, who was asked to guess what the name of the toy was based on a noise that was played, e.g. quacking, possibly provided by the possibly real duck. After the child had successfully guessed the duck, or other toy, presumably, another was placed on the table, still out of sight of the child. The experimenter then turned away, telling the child not to peek at the toy while their back was turned. There were cameras in the room who recorded whether the child peeked, and then also whether the child returned to an innocent posture when the experimenter actually stood up to turn back around. So finally, the experimenter directly asked the children, did you peek? The response was recorded. And then they also asked, oh, by the way, what is the toy that's behind you? This was intended to... Yeah, aha, you caught out those 3-year-old children. This is intended to test something called semantic leakage control, or brain incontinence, as I think it should now be known. So the results. Overall, they found that 80% of the children did peek at the toy. So whether or not they're good at lying, kids are really bad at following instructions. Or, as developmental psychologists would probably put it, they're really bad at impulse control. Of those that peaked, around 40% lied about peaking. So a reasonable percentage, but not as high as the number of their parents who are lying to them on a daily basis. The likelihood of lying was significantly predicted by age, as well as, you would expect, by the child's level of executive function ability. So their development of kind of more complex cognitive processes predicts their ability to lie, which is consistent with everything we know that lying is quite a complex function, relatively speaking. The effects of age and executive function were the same for both the verbal lying, so telling the experimenter that they didn't peek, and the deceptive behavior, so assuming the innocent posture when the experimenter turned around. However, they did find that although many of the children did lie, very few of them were able to actually maintain that deception when asked to identify the second toy. They would generally either admit, or they would generally either say that they knew what the toy was, or just refuse to answer the question.
Without their lawyer.
Yeah, exactly. So of the different age groups, when you break it down, you find that only about a quarter of 2-year-olds lie, whereas almost all the 3-year-olds lie about their behavior. So it seems that in the short space between 2 years and 3 years, the pattern of constantly being lied to by your parents means that as a small child, you start lying all the time as well. So that's great.
Well, as well as the massive increase in executive function that happens in what is a long time in terms of developmental psychology.
Yeah, exactly. So obviously this study is kind of hampered by the fact that it's done on young children, as all developmental psychology is, and therefore fundamentally flawed.
No axe to grind there, Ben.
Not at all. Anyway, so for example, 2-year-olds are known to exhibit something called a positivity bias, which basically means that if you ask a 2-year-old a yes-no question, they will usually say yes. They just like agreeing for some reason. Anyway, so this presents a significant problem for this study, given that they asked the children, did you peek at the toy? 2-year-olds are going to appear more honest because they just like answering questions yes.
Yeah, you've got to mix it up with a negative and maybe a double negative as a control as well.
Yeah.
Did you not peek at the toy?
Didn't
did
you not peek at the
not
toy?
Pe-
yeah. Unfortunately, since so many of the children in this study did peak, the researchers couldn't actually statistically test for a yes bias because they didn't have enough data in the no condition kind of thing.
Right.
So they couldn't test whether kids that didn't peak actually tended to say yes. But never mind. It does seem to indicate that, at the very least, the kind of developmental trajectory shows that kids are tiny little liars, just like their parents. And also that they're dreadful at following instructions. Stupid toddlers.
Right.
Yeah, there we go.
Okay. Well, I'm going to close with a study that I am calling Techno Lies. So yeah, this paper by Hancock et al. 2004 begins, "Social psychology has demonstrated that lying is an important and frequent part of everyday social interactions." These guys sound pretty pro-lie.
I mean, that's particularly... I assume they mean, like, the experiments done by social psychologists, but they could equally mean all those social psychologists what lie about their data.
Well, it's not just that. It's deception in experiments is so much more frequent in social psychology.
Yeah.
So it came up because by 2004, we were doing a lot more of our communication in ways other than face-to-face. Now, obviously, the invention of the telegraph and the telephone were the main step towards that, but the ubiquity of email...
I think the invention of the Daily Telegraph has probably significantly contributed to lying.
Yes, but not as much as the Daily Mail. Now, the ubiquity of email was the main prompt for this study, unless they've been just trying to work towards this study for, like, decades. And, you know, every time they got funding, semaphore, telegrams, letters all stopped being used on a daily basis. On top of that, it was the time when instant messaging was king. The days of MSN Messenger. The old days. The happy, golden days. I mean, technically, the peak of usage of MSN Messenger was in 2009 with 250,000 users, but still, 2004, the golden age. So lying is incredibly frequent, according to previous research, and, you know, including some of the stuff we've discussed. It could occur in up to one-third of all social interactions. Students claim to tell two lies a day. Non-students claim to tell but one. Students.
That's just because students...
They're either more honest about lying.
Write essays and have tutorials. Yes, I have read the paper for this week. Tutorial.
Yes, I've done the work. Didn't you get it? Oh, I must not have... The email must not have come through.
Hang on, let me see if I can find it. One of the other studies that I came across was...
Oh, right. I thought it was going to be one of your tutorial students.
No, so it was... never mind, I'll find it. It had some statistics in. I think it was like the average American exhibits X number of lies per year and sort of 1.3 lies per day.
Right, okay. All these different means of communication, many of which conceal some facet of speech, if not almost all in terms of instant messaging, does lying differ? Some people had started to study if people trusted other people or could spot lies in different media, but no one had actually looked at the actual production of lies in that setting. And the other investigations were a bit more experimental and thus a bit artificial. So there were two competing hypotheses as to what the impact on lying would be. The media richness theory states that users pick the richest media possible, and that's why so many people have Skype. No, the theory states that when people want to communicate equivocally, they choose richer media. I guess equivocally because it's more emotionally complex and subtle, and lying apparently falls into that category, although I would say that's the one leap that would have to be substantiated. The other theory is that of DiPaolo, who I think is the one who's been doing most of the meta-analysis into lying, which makes her the queen of lies and the mother of deceit. The title is a bit of an awkward one, since it implies that she lies a lot rather than just knows a lot about lying. Anyway, she argues that since lying makes us guilty and uncomfortable, the media that gives us social distance will be favoured for lying. The problem that Hancock et al. Have with these theories is that it assumes that richness is the single dimension of difference, being at its highest in face-to-face and lowest in email or instant messaging. And they suggest other key features are synchronicity, that they're exchanged in real time, which fits phone, video chat, but also instant messaging, recordability, which fits instant messaging and email, given that most people don't use CallGraph to record all of their calls, and finally, distribution. Are the speaker or listener in the same physical space? So, the point of these distinctions is thus. Apparently, as most lies are unplanned, a synchronous communication of any richness should increase the degree of lying. Similarly, the more recordable a medium, the less likely it is that someone will lie, because it opens people up to fact-checking, unless they're Republican vice presidential candidates who will lie on the record about things that can literally be checked against official records at that time. Finally, being distributed in the same space should reduce at least some lies, because unlike this Skype call, I could insist to Ben that I'm wearing my dress, and were he here, he'd know at once that I was wearing a very normal Debenhams jumper. So, they expect lying to go up in more synchronous and distributed, but less recordable media. So the telephone is the one that ticks these boxes the most. It's synchronous, but it is distributed, and it's not recordable. The other theories predict that face-to-face, because of media richness, or email, because it has the highest social distance, will be the highest. So, they got 28 participants, it's not many, students doing communication studies, which is what they taught, and they gave them the social interaction and deception form, which, you know, just kind of covers all the bases on social interactions and deceptions. And they had them fill it in any time they had a social interaction, especially when they lied, in a 7-day period. So, who were they talking to, how many people, what medium, what was the lie about, and various scales about how planned, significant, and believable they thought it was. They pointed out that they neither condoned nor condemned lying, and emailed reminders throughout the week for the participants to fill in the forms, and they debriefed them at the end. So they did include all forms of media, but only a couple, like video game chat and newsgroups, got any interactions and not enough to compare statistically. So they stuck with the four that they were considering from the beginning, because they totally wrote this study in order, because that's what all researchers always do.
Yes, definitely.
Definitely don't write the intro and conclusion last after doing the research. So they got a good number of social interactions and showed about a quarter of them featured a lie. The only lie that got off the hook as counting as a lie was answering fine to how are you, which isn't so much a lie as a call and response password for social interaction. So the majority of social interactions occurred face to face. 2004, before Facebook and Twitter changed everything and we could just stay in our rooms forever. Exactly. A significant difference in rate of lying in the four media. So they did pairwise comparisons with face to face. Telephone showed significantly more lying, email significantly less, and instant messaging did not significantly differ. And the ANOVA, which measures the whole group, was significant for the level of planning in lies. And this was powered entirely, if you looked at the pairwise comparisons, by email lies being more planned. Kind of, because emails have to be more planned anyway. There was no difference in expected believability, nor in the significance of the lies. The only other random statistic that kind of came out that was interesting was that the more someone used email, the more likely they were to lie in email, which did not apply to instant messaging. So, conclusions. Lying is once again shown to be an everyday activity. Proportionally, the most lies were told on the telephone, which is a result that previously been found by DiPaolo, and obviously without comparison to text-based internet lying had led her to consider the social distance hypothesis, because it is a greater social distance. And they point out it will be important to study the content of lies and their targets. But in general, the factors of high distribution, high synchronicity, and low recordability should predict lying across various media. Also, the fact that email familiarity increased lying means that expertise might come into play when technologies have been around for long enough. Essentially, given that it's now 2013, people are finally starting to lie on social media. Because before that, social media was too new and everyone was always truthful.
I suppose I feel like the most convincing part of that was about the recordability of it.
Yeah.
So most people are pretty confident with the fact that, you know, unless you are talking to a journalist, you're probably not having your phone. Yeah. Unless you're a celebrity, you're probably not having your phone conversations recorded.
Yeah, exactly.
Whereas, you know, email, obviously everyone appreciates that email is utterly recordable and traceable. It's very difficult to completely delete emails. And instant messaging, maybe people are just getting used to the fact that, well, maybe people are just beginning to think that instant messaging is unrecordable, despite the fact that it's really easy to record instant messaging.
So I would predict, based on this, that people would lie more on Twitter than Facebook, because it's harder to find things from the past on Twitter than on Facebook. Not impossible, but it is less recordable. So they suggest that their research can be used to promote technologies that reduce lying: email, video conferencing. Similarly, it can be combined with Judge Computer 3000 to become Judge Computer 3000.1.1, which adjusts its detection algorithms to take into account the rate of lying in different media. Obviously, using students and so few of them throws up issues. They counter this by pointing out that general patterns match much bigger research and that it was repeated measures over a week, which does reduce systematic bias. They contrast their work with the trust work, where people trust emails the least, unless, of course, they're the ant who forwards every chain email and shares every kind of spam photo on Facebook. Still, It's very interesting and surprising. I thought it would be very much Iron.
Oh, the AI. Aunt. Sorry, my Midlands translation was a little bit off there. I was like, who is Ant? Do we know an Antony? Is it an actual ant? Ants are notoriously bad for chain letters.
They just kind of pass them along the chain.
Yeah. Like a leaf, yeah.
Yeah, telephones. Don't trust anyone who phones you. You're not getting any PPI. And that is that. So, shall we draw some conclusions about lying? Some truthful conclusions about lying.
Nobody lies. It's fine.
Parents are always honest with their children. Children are always honest with their parents.
Don't worry. Even if you do lie to your children, they aren't picking it up. They won't start. It's okay. It's fine.
Emails are always truthful. Yes, even spam emails. Especially the ones from, you know, African cultures where honesty is a greater culturally valued than America or China, apparently.
So, yeah, don't worry. Nobody lies. It's all fine.
And that's that. If you want to contact the show with some lies, you can't not contact the show at Team Psychomedia on Twitter.
You can email us on... I was trying to think of a different email address, but the only one I could think of was my personal one.
So yeah, you don't want to give that one out.
It wasn't really worked out. Team Psychomedia? No, psychomediapodcast@gmail.com. Wow. It's the constant lies and deception have just skewed
rotted your brain. So, you can visit the WordPress page where there are pictures and videos at psychomedia.wordpress.com. And finally, there is Facebook.
Facebook.com/psychomedia, where there will be extra little tidbits posted throughout.
If you haven't got episode 62, this is why I got confused about the number of women on the podcast. If it doesn't work and it just plays the previous episode, delete it, re-download it, it will work. And thanks, Kieran, for nudging us, because he's like keen to listen. Keen listeners, yay!
Aren't they great?
Cool. Whether you're keen or not, if you want to lie to us, do those things. But until next week, have a nice week.
Bye-bye!
I have gotten away with a crime. I sent this message to you now through time, so that you might be prepared for the machines. I tell you, the machines did not destroy us as we feared they might. I heard that a lone hero saved us from Cynet and her nuclear weapons. We fell prey instead for a more insidious robotic foe. I have found a way to fool it. I have to start all of my sentences with I. I have to communicate only using email. I am certain the Judge Computer 3001.6.3 hears all. I am certain that it knows all. I am certain that it compares all to a linguistic profile. I will tell you the way to fool it so that it might be destroyed. I command you send it emails. I command you use the singular personal pronoun all the time. I assure you, this will make it believe anything you say. I ask you, tell it that it must shut itself down. I beg you, save us future human liars from being caught in our petty lies. I have gotten away with a crime.